Welcome to the Chicago Gamepreneur Podcast. We'll talk to fellow entrepreneurs and share stories of success, failures, and epic failures in the quest to understand the business, art, and science of the indie revolution in the city of big shoulders.
Well, I'm Kiwon Hong, and I'm here with my cohort Rob Lockhart. This is another episode of the Chicago Gamepreneur Show, and this is actually a special episode. We're going to break format a little, and I'm going to talk to Rob about Codemaster.
Great.
And you just wrapped up your Kickstarter, and it was, the results were, you can tell me about it, but I think it was just phenomenal.
Yeah, it definitely surpassed my expectations by a wide margin.
So how are you feeling? Like, after my Kickstarter, I know it just wore me out, like, physically and mentally. How are you feeling right now?
Yeah, a little bit of that. the day after my Kickstarter finished, I went out and I was my wife's field assistant in Washington. My wife's a scientist.
Okay.
She's collecting data, and that was really, really hard work. So I went from like hard work of a sort of social emotional type to the pure physical type. But I guess that's a good contrast.
Yeah, it's nice to kind of mix it up, right? For me it was a little different because like I was like waiting until like the last 2 days for me to pass the mark, whereas you surpassed that very early. But yeah, I imagine there were different sorts
of
pressures.
Fourth day,
yeah,
it was funded, but that was somewhat strategic, so I am planning to finish Codemaster no matter what, basically.
Right.
Uh-huh. So that the plan all along was like, this is going to help me concentrate on Codemaster and spend less time on contract gigs, and less time sort of saving up to get a budget for Codemaster.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. But I was going to make it no matter what happened. So, so I definitely purposely lowballed the goal.
Mm-hmm.
And that ended up being a really good decision, and I should shout out to Ryan Wiemeyer of the Hats, who gave me that advice.
Mm-hmm. Max Temkin did it too, right? Where he does like a Kickstarter for a game and it's like $500 and they surpass by 100 times or whatever. So
yeah, I think that his thinking, and also Ryan's when he does his own things, is that they not only are they planning to do the game anyway, but they really don't need the money. Like they they're pretty successful, so it's almost a marketing ploy and like a way of getting interest for that particular project for them. It's like an advertising medium.
Sure, it's like a good like pre-order. It takes care of the advertising, it takes care of the credit card payment stuff.
Yeah.
So in that regard, it's kind of a nice setup for you when you have a product that you know you're going to make, just to get some early exposure.
For sure.
On my side, like it was a much different feeling, I feel, because I needed the money to make it happen. So I don't know.
So
it's definitely
when
good.
When Kiwon
in that,
says
but,
for me, he, what he's talking about is for his project contract work.
Yeah, that's right. So I did a Kickstarter for contract work.
What's the URL? Contract work game.
Oh. Yeah. If you go, it's Facebook/contract work game. And I'm working on a new release of it now. And the Kickstarter wrapped up, I want to say maybe 14 months ago or something like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was definitely a different feeling for me because I was kind of going into it like thinking like, oh, I have to make this deadline or the game won't happen. Mm-hmm. I feel in retrospect that I like the way you're doing it better. Because when you put yourself in the kind of like you gotta make it or you're gonna fail, it puts a lot of constraints on you that probably lower the quality of the product. But I want to talk to you about stretch goals.
Yeah.
Because you hit your goal within 4 days, right? Mm-hmm. And then, I don't know, did you plan stretch goals ahead of time, or is it something like after you hit it, you were like, okay, I'm going to put something together?
I planned the stretch goals ahead of time, and I even had more, but I decided to rein it back like at the last moment. But I think that the things that that I added to the project, so we had three stretch goals basically. A level editor that would be sort of public facing, so I have to build a level editor anyway.
Right.
But it would be it's nice to sort of open that up to people to create their own stuff, and a course that would kind of bridge the gap between between the programming language that you learn in Codemancer, which I made up and has, you know, although conceptually very similar to a lot of programming languages, has no very direct application outside of the game,
mm-hmm.
Into a real programming language like Python. So bridging that gap, which I think is like a big step towards the usefulness of the game as an educational tool. And then, the third thing is a novel, young adult novel, set in the world of Codemancer. And I'm still auditioning authors to collaborate with me on that project. But I think that's a way to do two things. The book will have sort of spells, which are programs, in there, like at strategic moments, like, you know, she needed to do this thing, so and that it'll be sort of a tips and tricks guide in a way, as well as being a narrative, and so it'll be good for like players of the game to get deeper knowledge of programming and also of the sort of lore of the fictional background information, and it'll also be a way to get into the game from the book, so people who are into reading young adult fantasy.
Mm-hmm. Natural tie-in right there.
Yeah.
I really like the idea because it really weaves like the code learning part as part of the lore of the universe.
Mm.
So it's like it's you're writing a Tolkien novel, instead of like the songs, you put the code in there. It's kind of like this very like subtle insert. So what would you recommend? Should I start someone with the books, or should I start them with the game?
It depends on the type of person. That's what I think is great about it. It's like, if people are sort of already signed on to the idea that games can be a way of learning something, or they're just like really into games and maybe they have some interest in learning code beforehand, then they should start with the game. But mm-hmm. if they're sort of more into reading and fiction and maybe more of a humanities type person,
sure,
then I think the book is a really good entry.
Yeah, I can see, you know, more traditional learning programs might say, okay, let's check out the book as a way to kind of get kids interested, right? Let's get them thinking about it. And then when the kids are interested, then you maybe have like the game as like an option they can pursue or something like that.
It really probably seems backwards to a lot of people, but there are these kids that would rather read than play a video game. They exist. I was one of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think reading is a very, it's an easy thing to do, right? It's part of your natural like school curriculum, whereas like video games aren't maybe not necessarily part of a curriculum yet. Mm-hmm. So it may be easier to start with the books to, you know, maybe allocate a budget for the books before you can allocate a budget for the game.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not even thinking about, like, how it fits into schools, really.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, if I was, like, homeschooling my kid,
sure,
that might be.
Or if you got, like, a nephew or a niece you want to get interested in programming, right?
For sure.
It's much easier for you to just give them the book, you know, if you're on vacation on mm-hmm. them, you just give them the book, they can read it. And then afterwards, they have a kind of investment, right, in the universe, in the lore, mm-hmm. and then you can say, hey, there's a game you can check out, too. Whereas I feel, you know, unless you're, there are some people who are, as you said, like, more interested in games up front, so maybe that's the easier way, but for the other people, you know, this is a nice way to say, okay, let's get familiar mm-hmm. with the universe. And then if you want more, you can dive into the game.
Yeah. It's also, yeah, it's a passive medium versus an active medium. And it does take, like, energy and concentration to play a game, especially one that, like, you learn things.
That's true. I got a chance to play the early release of the demo of Codemaster, and there were definitely times where, you know, I'm an experienced coder, and I was sitting there going like, well, let me think about this. Let me go back through. So yeah, it's definitely something that requires, you know, active mental.
Yeah, and there's unfortunately, like, I mean, I wish that I could make it sort of as smooth to learn as like an action game. But there's really no way around, you know, using your brain.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about code is it just requires a certain amount of investment, in my opinion. Now, I'll be honest about this. I was a terrible coder when I first started coding. I went into college.
Who wasn't?
Yeah, I think it's like maybe except for maybe John Carmack or something like that, right? People generally just aren't good at coding when they first start. And for me, it took, you know, 2 semesters of college, getting awful grades, and just writing a lot of code, and then very, very gradually, I got better at it. I think for most people, that's the way it's going to be. It's like you kind of build up the mental skill set, the mental model to code, and I think the game is a great way to do it, because we do have, I don't know, like games encourage us to take on challenges that are harder than we would be willing to do otherwise, right? That's one of the great powers that games have. So I think it's a great model, it's a great vehicle to kind of get kids involved with that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the only counter argument to that is that, like, not many games have really succeeded at it. But yeah, I'm hoping that that's like a failure of design and execution, and not a failure of like potential.
Well, I'm not sure if it was you or another person that wrote about it in a blog post, but I think the bar's been set very low, right? There's a point where we got a lot of this educational, like almost shovelware type games, which really, you know, it set the bar so low that no one was really looking to do anything interesting.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, it's set the bar low in a bad way, where like, no one thought anyone could jump over. Kind of like that period before the Fosbury flop.
Right, yeah.
When people thought, like, well, this is as high as we can jump. Yeah, but I think people are sort of making the equivalent of the Fosbury flop now.
In general, I saw a couple other Kickstarters that are doing something similar. And just in general, it seems like there's a bigger push for educational games. Do you feel that it's something that is like a greater thing happening like outside that everyone's thinking about, or just is something that we have to push more for?
Yeah, I think that there are places where people are not convinced, and perhaps rightly so. But overall, I think there's a lot of buy-in, like a surprising amount of buy-in. I mean, there was sort of an advisor to President Obama, Constance Steinkuhler, who's like, mm-hmm. her main research focus is games and learning, and she's very much on board with the idea that education in the future will have a lot to do with games and game-like learning. So, yeah, people are almost, in my opinion, a little bit too ready to accept the idea that video games, not just games, but video games specifically, are a good way to teach a variety of things. And that might be just like the sort of general grasping at anything that can help our educational system. But it's benefited me, so I can't complain. And, you know, it's benefited the Codemaster project and sort of the movement that is behind that, like, coding is a valuable thing to learn and video games are a good way of teaching things, and that we can combine those two ideas.
Yeah. So I want to get into a little more of the brass tacks of the Kickstarter, but before I do that, I wanted to just point out that in your like opening statement on that Kickstarter, you said you want to knock down the barriers, right? You're looking for young adults, you're looking for a female protagonist. I think that's really great in terms of just opening it up to the rest of the market. I guess we're recording this, it's the third week of June. We've just gotten through E3 and all the controversy about the Assassin's Creed game not putting in a female character.
Yeah.
So I think that is a very important thing, just to say, like, we need to be conscious that the choices we make in our design can block out a portion of the audience if we're not thinking about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, making a learning game that teaches code is not a unique idea to Codemancer. As much as like I talk about it, I mean, it's relatively rare compared to, you know, how many games are about shooting.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not, you know, it's not unique. But I think the one of the things that distinguishes Codemancer is that it doesn't sort of preach to the choir. And I feel like a lot of games and other tools intended to teach programming are sort of made for people who are likely to learn programming even without those tools or games. So that's the opposite of what I'm trying to do, is bring people in who wouldn't otherwise do it. And in large part, that means women and girls.
Yeah, if you look at the discrepancy between, you know, males and females in the STEM fields, right? The science, technology, and math is just, engineering and math. There's such a gap there.
And it didn't used to be that way. I mean, programming used to be 100% females.
Mm.
I mean, at first there was just one.
Right.
there was one programmer in the world, and it was a woman. And then later on, like sort of in the ENIAC days, it was considered sort of almost secretarial work to be a programmer because it involved sort of switchboards. Like the actual interface that a programmer used was very similar to like a telephone operator switchboard.
Interesting. Uh-huh.
So it was considered sort of women's work, but then it's been sort of less and less female dominated over time, and tipped way in the opposite direction. And that trend continues. So like, there are fewer and fewer women getting advanced degrees in computer science year over year. So that's a trend that is not healthy.
Yeah, I think it's really unfortunate, because programming is actually one of those jobs where it doesn't require as much face-to-face interaction. Like, if you were, I mean, I work with a team that's probably 50% remote. Mm-hmm. I haven't met probably four of the guys that I work with. It's all remote. And really, I would compare it to, they call this the blind audition. But in Europe, what they used to do is they would have auditions for orchestras, right? The big orchestras. Mm-hmm. And they bring the contestants in and have them play, and they would look at them and subconsciously they're making all these judgments based on the gender of the person playing. Mm-hmm. So a woman can never play French horn. They couldn't play trombone.
Huh.
What they did is they changed the setup, so they put up a blind. So all they did was listen. And that completely evened the numbers in Europe.
Huh.
People were absolutely shocked, stunned, when they would push the blind back and see the woman back there.
So, like, programming careers have that potential.
I absolutely think so. That programming is one of those things where you can judge so much off straight performance.
Mm-hmm.
That it could be a big equalizing factor. So I think it's very unfortunate that we don't have more female interest in the field. And I think it's, you know, there's a lot of culture stuff that goes in there, but part of it is that there's just not anything to draw women in. It's such a, like, a male-dominated culture.
Yeah,
but it's hard to get girls interested in it. So
yeah, I mean, there's definitely cultural messaging very early on. Like, if you look at the hacker character in movies, it's always like a white dude with glasses, probably like in his late 20s, early 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's a message that's hard to get away from. Like, you know, that's not me, is what people say to themselves.
Sure, yeah.
Biggest exception I can think of is in 24, who at the
Oh, yeah, Chloe Ryan.
Is a plausible, you know, a woman that's you know, very plausibly doing her job. Like, the writing is good enough that she doesn't sound like a doofus.
Well, I think one of the other characters that you could talk about is Trinity from The Matrix, which, unfortunately, she starts out as a very strong character.
Yeah.
And then over the course of the timeline...
she becomes damseled.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Which is really too bad.
Yeah.
But, truly. Yeah. Anyway, let's... after that long tangent, let's talk about some of the brass tack stuff. Because, obviously, you did an amazing campaign, great results. How much, like, pre-planning did you do? Because I know you're playing this thing out for... What, a very long time.
I kind of knew that I was going to do a Kickstarter from the very beginning of starting that project. You know, lucky enough to know a bunch of people like yourself who have done Kickstarters and had, like, really good advice for me.
Do you think that helps to find the Kickstarter vets and just pick their brains?
Absolutely. Or just, like, expose yourself to the advice they put out there. I know you, like, you wrote a blog post specifically about that, and a bunch of other people have. The Hats did, and I got a meeting with Max Temkin and talked to him about stuff, and there was actually, like, an event here in Chicago where a panel of people talked about their Kickstarter experiences, and they were all game developers, and sort of half the projects on the panel were successful at Kickstarter, and half were unsuccessful Kickstarters. So you got to see sort of what very directly what worked for them, what didn't work for them.
Anything stand out between the successes and failures?
Well, on that panel, a big dividing line was the size of the project. So,
okay.
One of the unsuccessful Kickstarters who is coming back, so look out for them, is Mutant League Football.
Yes, I know.
And that's like a AAA size game, and they were sort of, they cut it down a lot. It was like a third of a AAA budget. But that's still, like, very, very big in Kickstarter terms.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I feel those kind of projects, it's basically within the first 4 or 5 days you know whether it's going to work or not. Because once you fall behind the ball on something that big, it's just, you know, you've got all this negative momentum that just kind of slows it down. So people go in and go, well, you've got, you know, 25 days left and you've got $1,000 out of, you know, $500,000. There's no way you're going to make it. So I feel like, yeah. Like, getting out the gate fast for those kind of projects is really important.
Mm-hmm. I mean, most projects see most of their pledges happen in the first couple of days and then the last couple of days, right? So if you're not, like, at least halfway by, you know, a couple of days in, it gets discouraging.
Yeah, there's a terrible, what, the middle period of the Kickstarter where you're just, you know, what happened?
Yeah.
And, you know, everyone tells you about it, but it still doesn't feel any better when it's just Kickstarter. So, is there anything that surprised you in the course of the Kickstarter? Something that you thought would do very well and didn't do well? Or something?
Oh, the trickle. That's why I said that. It's the middle, the middle, like, lull in the middle. And I had, like, phone alerts set up, so... Like, when things were good, like, I was getting phone alerts, like, bing, 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 bing. And then, like, some days it was, like, 2 or 3.
Yeah, and it just like, it just feels like, not, like everything what is happened? So
What
slow.
What did I
everything
do?
Everything is just so, yeah, it's terrible.
Did I say something wrong in my last update? Like,
I'll have to say that.
And also people who, reduce or remove their pledges.
I was about to say that depledging is the worst.
Yeah.
It just kills you. And even if you get, like, 10 pledges, when one person de-pledges, it just feels awful.
Yeah. And I'm sure that people, like, you know, I tried to tell myself, like, these people probably have just personal reasons for doing that. Like, everybody has budgets that they live off of. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can't spend all of your money on Kickstarter.
It's true.
Maybe they saw a project they liked more, or maybe they just decided they couldn't. You know, they went out to dinner or they went drinking one night and blew their Kickstarter budget. Yeah. But yeah, it hurts anyway.
Yep, I agree. And that's one thing you should just prepare yourself for. I mean, I think I was just shocked that someone could just pull their funding like that, right? You at least to say, like, oh, you got to wait till, like, X amount of days or something, right? But no, anytime you can just cancel it. So
yeah.
It is disappointing to see the chart go down.
Yeah. Luckily, it was none of the big tier backers that pulled out.
So anything that surprised you in terms of, you know, something that you expected to do well and it didn't, or something that you expected would have minimal impact and got a bunch of response?
The biggest surprise of the campaign probably was, like, minutes after the project was funded,
mm-hmm.
it became the project of the day on the front page of Kickstarter.
Yeah, that was big.
And there's pretty much nothing bigger for a Kickstarter project, like, to be the first thing that somebody sees when they get on the page.
So is there anything, were you talking with anyone to make that happen, or is it just kind of word of mouth?
I was talking at some people, so I didn't get response, but maybe that's what did. I mean, I've tweeted at people, and, like, I went to college with a guy who was an early hire at Kickstarter,
mm-hmm.
and I've just, like, sent them messages like, hey, I have a Kickstarter up.
Yeah, I'm sure it doesn't hurt, right? I mean, like, yeah, maybe they get 1,000 messages a day, but maybe they look at it, right?
Yeah. So. But, yeah, didn't hear anything back. So maybe that had an impact. Maybe it didn't. I don't know. Maybe they saw it randomly.
Or yeah.
It was different people who put it up. I have no way of knowing. It's all just a black box back there in Kickstarter headquarters.
Yep. And, I mean, that's the question that I get a lot, is people ask, you know, how do I get featured? How do you put on the email? So I got no idea.
Yeah. I mean, one way to get on the email, which I didn't have happen, which is to get a Kickstarter employee to pledge.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
So there's like a section of like things that we're things following or whatever, and then there's a section below that of like things we pledged to.
Okay.
Or things we backed. Terminology.
So maybe stock all the Kickstarter employees and see what their interests are.
Make friends with them over the course of 12 years. Be the best man at their wedding, and then start your Kickstarter campaign.
It's a very slow burn. So your pledge levels. Mm-hmm. I noticed that you did some adjustments on that during, like, midstream, which I did as well. What were your thoughts there? What worked? What didn't?
Well, it was really nice to have names for all the pledge tier levels.
Mm-hmm.
That
was cool. Yeah, I like that one.
Yeah, I just named them after roughly synonyms of the word wizard. And it really helped me keep them straight in my head. And it also, I think people liked being sort of associated with, like, oh, I'm a mage or whatever.
Yeah.
The things that I added, you can't subtract things, first of all.
Like, right, once once someone's pledged to it, that level is locked in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The only thing you can change is adding to the quantity of that. Mm-hmm. If you have a limited quantity, you can add more.
Yep.
Later on. Which I did with one of the tiers because, I figured out that, it's sort of a creative tier, like somebody who's contributing creatively to the game, and I wanted to keep it very small at first, and then I sort of figured out that, like, I had bandwidth for more people if I set it up so that, like, I could interact with them over, through a forum or that kind mm-hmm. of system. And I could still get to know that number of people. And I'm reasonably certain that I can get to know that number of people because it's about the number of people that my dad gets to know every single year as a school teacher.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
So over the course of this year, I'll get to know all the people in that backer tier and a few other backer tiers that are creative. But all the rest of the tiers that I added were related to the stretch goals, so I couldn't add those.
Okay.
I couldn't have those tiers before.
Before the stretch goals were defined. All right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In terms of, yeah, and you don't have to give any exact numbers, but general, did you see more money come in on the low end, or was it mostly in the high level pledges?
By far, the highest pledge count was at the $20 level, which is the level where the first level that the game is included, and it's basically the first level there is. I mean, mm-hmm. the one before that is like thank you,
right,
for donating, which is. Which I do appreciate a lot, and those people will be mentioned in the credits. But the first level that I anticipated people sort of backing at was that $20.
Yeah, it was similar for my campaign, where if you would look at the total amount of money that came in, there's definitely a spike at that. I think I was 25 for the game, so there's a spike at 25, and then on the mm-hmm. high end, I just. You know, did the math, so, you know, there's a bunch of contributions there. But, yeah, in terms of like, just pure numbers, the $25 was by far the biggest category yeah. for me, too.
And Kickstarter tells you that straight up, like, in their FAQ. They're like, most people are at the $20 to $25 level.
Yep.
But I'm actually surprised, like, the Archmage level, there were only two of them, mm-hmm. $1,500 to become one of the teachers that teaches Aurora some aspects of programming. And I didn't expect anybody to back at that level. It just seems ludicrously large sum of money. But that tier was filled.
Wow.
Both of them.
That's very impressive.
Yeah.
So to maybe look forward a little, would you do another Kickstarter? Would it be something you'd be interested in? Or if you're not interested, what would you do different if you could go back in time and redo this one?
I would do it again, I guess. It's hard to think about because like I haven't delivered.
Right, you're right out of there, right? Yeah, you're still fresh out. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like, you know, even thinking about that is kind of irresponsible without having, like, given, you know, everything that I've promised
for sure.
this first mm-hmm. Kickstarter. But if I had to do something differently, it would definitely be to reach out to the press earlier and more. It was kind of something that, like, I knew before I launched, like, this aspect of my preparation has kind of fallen by the wayside,
mm-hmm.
But fingers crossed it won't be so bad. And that's true, I think, for the most part. Like, very few of the coverage that I did get, I mean, I didn't get huge coverage, but I did. I got a Kotaku mention, but that... In terms of that, didn't translate into pledges really.
Oh, okay, interesting.
From what I can tell, so I don't think that, like, if I had to discard some element of my preparation, that wasn't the worst.
Thing yeah, that was the worst thing to get rid of. Yeah.
To get rid of. So, yeah, but still, I always wonder, like, oh, if I had, you know. Bugged somebody at Polygon more
uh-huh.
and gotten the feature there, like what could have happened. But and it's good to have those relationships anyway, which would have been another thing that could have sort of come out of the Kickstarter as a byproduct.
Sure.
But didn't.
Well, you got time now, so
yeah. I hope yeah.
And you got a successful Kickstarter to you know, push too, so that always helps.
It's very validating. I'm sure you agree.
Yeah, it's very
it's
good.
Like, hey, people
is want one of this the game best feelings people... to actually hit that number.
Yeah.
That's interesting about the press, because I got a small mention in one of the Rock, Paper, Shotgun articles when they were doing mm-hmm. this, you know, reoccurring Kickstarter roundup. And a lot of my just pure like stranger pledges came from that mention.
Hmm.
So, but it may be that we're just looking at different audiences, right?
Well, I mean, my number one source, I mean, they give you like a listing on the
website. Right, they give you the breakdown, yep.
Is unknown.
Unknown.
So it's possible that
you have no idea where these people are coming from.
I just assume that it's like direct links that I've sent out to, like I had a, that was one of the better things that I did preparation-wise is as soon as I started development on Codemancer, I also started a mailing list. And everywhere I went, like conferences and things, mm-hmm. I would sign people up for that mailing list. So I assumed that a lot of those were from mailing list or from like echoes of people mentioning it.
Yeah, I hear a lot about like how email is surprisingly effective. Once you have that list,
mm-hmm.
that you can get a lot of like buy-in or action engagement from people just off the list.
Yeah, I mean, social media definitely casts a wider net,
mm-hmm.
but like if people have signed up for your mailing list, then they already are interested in what you're working on.
So. What would you say the rough like ratio of like your the size of your list to the number of backers? And I know they're not like exactly related, but I'm just curious what the ratio would be.
Oh, I mean, I have no idea because I only have one data point for each, right?
Okay.
I have, you know, 500 people on my mailing list and like 1,800 people backed. So.
Yeah, that's pretty good. That's interesting, though. Very cool. So I wanted to just talk about, you had a very... like a very strong, like unique message that came through on your Kickstarter. You know, beyond the I'm making an educational game, it was, you know, I'm making an educational game that brings down the barriers, mm-hmm. that, you know, engages young adults. How much do you think that contributed to your success? Because when I watch your video, when I read your Kickstarter, it really feels different than other educational games, right? Because a lot of games will say, okay, we're teaching stuff, you know, we're going to make it fun, this is our cool little video game. But yours actually felt like there was you know, more to it, that you had a real purpose in mm-hmm. what you were doing.
Yeah, I mean, that was like advice that Max Temkin gave me. Originally, I wanted to sort of pitch it just purely as a game. Like, mm-hmm. I wanted the video to be mostly like a trailer for the game.
Okay.
But that sort of assumes a level of buy-in to that idea of, like, educational games are reasonably effective.
Right, yes.
and still can be fun. Max said, basically, like, you need to sell that idea. You need to sell this as a cause, basically.
Mm-hmm.
The cause is partially... kids should get... there's, like, a lot of aspects to the sort of cause of... That Codemancer helps to further, I suppose. That kids should get into programming early.
Mm-hmm.
That girls especially should get into programming early. Or more of them should.
Yep.
And also that games are a good way to teach, period. But
yeah.
Also mm-hmm. programming specifically. And so I did spend a lot of the video sort of selling that idea. Like, you see kids engaged in playing, they are playing my game. But there's a lot of, like, if you watch a video of people playing any game, even like critically acclaimed games, and there's like a photo series that proves this, that like Jane McGonigal talked about in her TED Talk, which is like people playing games, having fun. They'll tell you they're having fun, but their faces look so, like, disappointed or, like, angry or like, almost a bored face if they're super, like, engrossed
mm-hmm.
because they're just, like, waiting for ideas to come out of their subconscious almost.
Okay.
So, like, 90% of my footage of kids playing the game is, like, really... it looks terrible. It looks like they're having the worst time of their lives. But that's, like... that would be true. I mean, right... I, the the kids, some of the kids that playtested my game were from the Minecraft Club at Chicago Quest, which is like a middle and high school. Mm-hmm. And if you watch them play Minecraft, which is like their favorite game, same thing.
Same face, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and there's like tournament mods for Minecraft that they play and stuff like that. But yeah, I cherry picked the moments where they were like really excited to have completed some challenge.
Yeah, the aha moment, right?
Yeah. And I think that's something that parents want to see for their kids and teachers want to see for their students, is like the epiphany.
Mm-hmm.
So part of what I was selling sort of is the epiphanies.
Yeah, no, it was a really good video. I do want to say, like, I remember doing this for my video.
4 years of NYU Film School and $200,000 later, it was a decent Kickstarter video.
it was a very long plan. We've planned this for so long. How many takes did it take for you to do the personal part? Because that was the worst for me. Like, I thought I would just walk through my Kickstarter pitch, and when I went on camera, I was just a mess. Like, thank God I had a fantastic editor for my stuff, but it was so bad. I'm amazed they got any usable footage out of it.
Yeah, I mean, I actually wrote the text for what I was going to say and ran it by a bunch of people, including Ryan, our friend, who does PR.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like reasonably sure that the text was okay.
Yeah.
And then delivering it, I actually feel like I kind of flubbed it.
I think everyone feels that a little, but
especially because I didn't memorize it, which, you know, I've been trained as an actor a little bit. And I know that, like, the first step to delivering any kind of good performance is to memorize your lines. But I didn't do it. I read it off of a screen. So that was, I feel like I kind of flubbed that. But the good takes that I picked out were, like, takes where I had just read it off the screen and then, like, basically repeated it to myself.
Okay.
Right after that. So I didn't really memorize it, but I was kind of working off of my memory.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's that's how I feel about that part of it.
I'm not so happy. Yeah, I feel it's a really tough part of the Kickstarter, because a lot of people that, like, especially for the video game stuff, right, they're just not used to being, you know, someone who engages well on camera. So it's definitely a challenge. And a lot of Kickstarters, you know, like, I'll watch the little gameplay trailer and be really excited, and the guy comes on and talks, like, oh man, I just skipped through.
Another great thing about doing the video is that my wife has what I refer to as a bad Kickstarter video allergy. If she sees, like, the beginning of a bad Kickstarter video, she's like, no, it's hearts, turn it off. Like, she gets, like, viscerally disgusted by it, I guess. And, you know, it's weird. It doesn't correlate exactly with, like, which Kickstarters do well,
mm-hmm.
but just which Kickstarters have a bad video. Because some Kickstarters that do really well have a bad video, and it's just such a good product or project that, you know,
yeah, it just overcomes it. Yeah.
But yeah, she also has, like, that. And it's not necessarily, she won't necessarily, like, tell you which one was a really good video, but she knows when it's horrible.
Right, right. There's a aversion to the bad ones. It's the canary in the coal mine thing.
Exactly.
Right?
I don't want to name names. But I'll tell you later which ones she reacted really poorly to.
Just don't tell me if it was mine. It'll crush me.
No, it wasn't.
I already hit my goal, so all right. So any last thoughts? Anything? Well, what's your plan now? Because you blasted through your goal. You hit, mm-hmm. what, 4 of your stretch goals?
Yeah.
So how's it looking right now? Are you kind of, like, just figuring out where you're going from here? Are you?
Yeah. Well, I just recently sort of got the money. So that
right, it takes a while to come in through, and then you know Amazon takes a cut and everything.
Yeah,
and then which is maybe the saddest part about the Kickstarter is when you see the Amazon cut and just go, ah. Oh. Yeah, continue.
I mean, a lot of it is the credit processing, so it's not even them; it's like Visa, and
right? Yes, yeah.
But I think it, you know, we've got enough money to make this game.
Yep.
So that's a good, absolutely good thing. And I've sort of mobilized the team. Myself, in recent weeks, I've been sort of more consumed with client work lately because my sort of... What I raised on Kickstarter is my Codemancer money, and now I have to get my, like, eating money.
Sure. Yeah. That's important, isn't it?
Which I'd been almost neglecting during the Kickstarter, understandably.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So I'm playing catch up a little bit with client work at the moment, but today I spent a long time investigating how to stream development on Twitch.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So soon, hopefully, I want to start like a thing where every week I just write some Codemancer code and stream it. So I'll be making some progress.
Let me know how that goes, because coding is one of those things I feel like. It's like a Heisenberg principle that if you, like, watch me do code, I'd be awful at it. Like, for some reason, I just, like, even though there would be nobody in the room, just the idea that I was on camera would make me awful at coding.
I think I'm going to set expectations low.
Okay.
That's my hope, is that it's like, yeah, I'm, you know, kind of, at this point, a game designer first and a programmer second.
Mm-hmm.
And, so you're going to see me do a bunch of weird, terrible things. And I'm sorry if it hurts your eyes. And, you know, feel free to tell me in the comments, like, if there's a better way to do what I'm trying to do.
Well, no, I applaud you for being brave enough to do it. As I said, I would never try it.
I haven't tried it yet, so...
I'm also not sure,
you
like...
You might have scared me off.
I'm not sure what my code face looks like. Right? It's not like every code in the mirror. It's like, I don't know what I do with my face when I code, you know?
That's the other thing I have to figure out. Yeah, that's more of a technical thing, but I it looks like on Mac there's no way to stream both your screen and your webcam.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Which would seems like
there should be. I mean, bad, yeah, somebody should have figured that out. But
it's easy on Windows and impossible on Mac, such as Mac life.
Yeah. Well, I think we're probably way over time, but let's just go through quickly and do our what we're so.
Sure.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So I'm still in my. I'm still in my whirlwind tour of young adult fantasy, and I've just read recently. I read the first Percy Jackson and the Olympians.
Oh yeah,
and I'm gonna definitely continue that series. I hear that it's very popular. It's just like it's just slightly after my time and my little sister's time, so we kind of missed it.
Okay.
And the movies, apparently, like, I didn't even know there were movies.
I'll admit that I was, I think I was between jobs, and I had about 4 weeks off, nothing to do, and I did watch the first one, which was not bad, it wasn't great, but the mythology, like, that mythology always interests me, so.
I think they do a really good job of, like, it's very coherent in that, like, if you know anything about the Greek gods, you know that they're very promiscuous, and they fathered a lot of half-human sort of babies.
Yep.
And that's sort of the premise, is that they continue to do that, and there are kids out there now that are, you know, sons and daughters of Zeus and Athena and I've forgotten his Greek name. What's Neptune's Greek name?
Poseidon.
Poseidon.
Yeah,
that's right. And Percy Jackson is a son of Poseidon. Yeah, and there's a lot of things and that they sort of explain, and it seems to make perfect sense. Like the fact that Mount Olympus is accessible or is closest at any given time to the sort of accepted center of Western civilization. So, it was Greece, and then it was Rome.
Yep.
And now it resides above the Empire State Building.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. There's a bunch of things that just seem to work, to fit really well, and I admire sort of that, the coherence of their sort of lore. Yeah, what I don't admire is that they further the sort of inheritance of magic idea that a lot of magical fiction adopts, and I wrote a whole blog post about this.
I was about to just talk about that.
And the idea that basically you're either born with the ability to do magic or you're not, and if you're not, there's nothing you can do about it. You're just a regular Joe Schmo.
Yeah.
And you have to, use a toaster instead of making fire coming out of your fingertips or whatever.
Right. No matter how hard you try, right?
Yeah.
You're still, yeah.
And so that's true of this universe for certain. That, if you're not a daughter or son of one of these gods, you're up the creek or whatever. You're just a normal person. And not only can you not do magic, you're not even sort of aware of its existence. Even if it happens right in front of you, your brain kind of filters it out within this mythology. So it's really pathetic. And that's something that I'm trying to get away from in Codemancer. In Codemancer, if you apply yourself, you can learn to do magic.
Why do you think so many of these books have that trend where it's like genetic or, kind of random selection?
Well, they have to show somehow, why isn't everyone doing magic?
Mm-hmm.
And that, I guess that's sort of the simple, lazy way out. And it's also, kind of well accepted. It's been done many, many times before, and so it's kind of like nobody gets fired buying IBM. Nobody objects to it because it's been done so much that, it's kind of too late to voice your objections.
Yeah, I think it might be, someone was saying that when you start writing something and you don't sit down and work out everything before, when you run into a block, you just go back to the most recent thing you can kind of reference.
Uh-huh.
And since that's such a common theme, I think it may be that people just, they go back to that. That's the reference that they go back to.
And I think that it may have been a mythology put in place originally to sort of make leaders, it's the divine right of kings, right?
Yeah.
Make leaders seem like, it's right and proper for them to be, living in a castle and served by all these people because, they're endowed with some ability by God or fate or whatever.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. But we don't have kings anymore, or most of us.
It's interesting that it's stuck with us, even though we at least try to advocate democracy and, the right of the people as much as we can.
Yeah.
So
it's weird. There are some things that are deep like that are just so old that serve us well.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are some things that we should just throw away, in my humble opinion.
Yeah. Well, to that point, my what word for the week is I read the new Freakonomics book, Think Like a Freak, which was very interesting. If you listen to all their podcasts, not all the material will be entirely new, but it's still an interesting read. And they actually, I'm not going to spoil it for anyone, but they run an experiment that they started in the second book.
Mm.
They tell you the conclusion of in the third book.
Oh.
And it's hidden. You didn't know you were taking part in the experiment, but it happened. So.
Oh, we were taking part in it.
Yes.
Oh, boy.
Well, we in the very, general sense that the public was basically
okay.
fed.
Okay, not like readers of the second book.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
There's a very specific demographic. Okay. But yes, it was interesting. But I think the part that was particularly maybe good for me was they said that the three hardest words in the English language to say are I don't know. And I thought about it because I did start my career in a very corporate setting, right? I work even at the startups I was at, right? You'd be asked, you know, can we do this? And the answer was like, you can never say I don't know. Uh-huh. It was always like you put together something, even if you have 5% of the data, you put together something and you give some sort of answer.
Right.
And I think it's prevalent in society that we have this idea that you have to have some type of answer, whereas I think we get into a lot of trouble because we're just taught this and we have to have answers. So
yeah.
You know, a lot of,
I mean, that's sort of the leader archetype too.
Yeah.
It's like a very,
it's true. Yeah. Like the leader always has the answer, right? And if he says I don't know, everyone panics, right?
Yeah.
Well, and I think,
but that's not necessarily necessary anymore.
I don't think so at all, because we've made such good steps in figuring out like how to collect data, how to do like good experiments, you know, figure out how to do like control groups and randomization correctly, that like if you don't know something, like just take the time to figure it out. And I'm saying this like as much to myself as anyone else. Like,
I mean, that does take resources, so it may be that you don't have the resources to actually find out something, and then you just have to guess. But at least if you don't pretend that you know something, then you'll know that it's a guess.
Yes,
and
it's true.
You can reconsider it later.
Yeah, and I think that just like upfront being honest about like, well, I don't have a lot of data, I can't really make a good conclusion, is better than, you know, just making something up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just be upfront about it. And I think that's something that I want to try to do more in my development, is, you know, when I don't know how something's going to go, one, I'm going to say it upfront, and two, I'm going to try to run experiments. I'm really bad at, like, figuring out good experiments to run,
mm-hmm.
but it's definitely something that I'm going to try, like, work on, just in terms of, you know, like, how to price, how to advertise, how to, you know, like, do tutorials, stuff like that. Which is all stuff that, like, people have been doing for a while, but we're still not good at it. So.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I'm very much subject to that, like, reticence to go out and collect real data.
Yeah, it's tough. It's a lot of work, and sometimes the results are really bad, so...
But yeah, it's worth it.
Yep. All right, cool. Well, thanks for taking the time to talk. I know
pleasure.
Must have been like a crazy couple months here, but congratulations again on a fantastic Kickstarter.
And to you, 14 months late.
Yeah, that's right. All right, until next time.
Thanks for tuning in the Chicago Gamepreneur Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you'll be back again to share more stories from Sweet Home Chicago.